From WBUR Boston, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The American economy on a slow but sure road to recovery? No, says the former budget director for President Ronald Reagan, David Stockman. The former Reagan man is out with a fiery, scathing indictment of what America has become politically and economically. He blames Republicans. He blames Democrats. He blames crony capitalism and too much federal spending and the Fed. We're in bigger trouble, he says, than we think. This hour on Point, David Stockman wrestling with American doom. You can join the conversation. How do you see the message, the messenger, the American reality now? Is Stockman right? You can comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Washington is David Stockman. He was President Ronald Reagan's budget director from 1981 to 1985 and a former Republican congressman from Michigan. An architect of Reagan's supply-side policies, he left the administration after falling out over deficit spending, went to the private sector, joining Solomon Brothers and later the Blackstone Group in private equity. He's been a critic of both major parties for some time now. His big new book is The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America, which paints a fairly terrifying picture of the U.S. economy and future. David Stockman, welcome back to On Point.
Tom, I'm very happy to be with you.
You write that we should be very afraid that the United States is broke fiscally, morally, and intellectually. What's the case you're making, David?
Well, I think our economy has been deformed and perverted and eroded by way too much government, both fiscal intervention and deficits and stimulus and tax cuts and incentives for every different sector of the economy for so many years. But more important, the Fed is so out of control in terms of the fantastic rate at which it's flooding Wall Street with new cash and printing money and driving interest rates to the very floorboard of the economy, which is to say zero, that all of this is simply creating an economy that's prone to bubbles that periodically allows Wall Street to capture huge windfall gains from speculation, but leaves the Main Street economy increasingly in trouble, distress, and, lacking growth. And we can see that just in the last 12 years, the real economy has barely crept forward. We've created very few jobs at all, and no middle-class jobs, full-time, decent-paying jobs. Meanwhile, the stock market, which is at a peak today, is only at the same point it was way back, in March 2000, before the dot-com bust wiped out about $5 trillion of household wealth and 401k plans and so forth. They reflated the bubble under Greenspan's 1% interest rates. We had the great housing boom, which was a disaster for so many millions of families who were lured into mortgages they couldn't afford. That ultimately peaked in the credit and stock market boom of 07 and 08, and then we had the great Wall Street meltdown. $7 trillion was blown away this time in terms of household wealth and stocks, housing, 401k plans, and so forth. And then before we even could begin to sober up from all of this, the Bernanke Fed was back at it, printing money at fantastic rates, reflating the bubble within weeks. And now, after 4 years of this, we're back where we started with Wall Street, being showered with huge gains. The market's up 115%, and the Main Street economy is still struggling and barely inching forward. So something is fundamentally wrong, and I say it's the bubble policies of the Fed. It's the massive deficit and interventionist meddling policies of Washington in so many different ways.
You pin blame in a very big and deep way on both parties. You say that Washington has been unable to rein in either the warfare state, as in war, or the welfare state. You go after Republicans, you go after Democrats. What's your critique of each?
Well, you know, the warfare state is just a big way or a fancy way of talking about the defense budget, our foreign policy, our penchant for intervening in so many places in the world where it's none of our business, and particularly the two great wars, mistaken wars of intervention and occupation that we've had since 2000. I argue that none of this should have happened, and it wouldn't happen if we had a right-sized defense budget that would be dramatically lower than what we have today. We're still spending $650 billion. I point out in the book that if we go all the way back to Eisenhower, who was the only real war hero and general that we've had in this century as president, he reduced the defense budget to what would be the equivalent of $400 billion today. That the bloated defense budget that he inherited from Truman in the Korean War. And he said in 1960, beware of the military-industrial complex. He said in 1960, even when we were facing what was a menacing, Politburo in Moscow in the Soviet era, that $400 billion was enough to preserve our security, but not too much to undermine our economy. Now, why are we today, in 2013, with no industrial enemies left in the world, the Cold War long over, Russia, Soviet Union disappeared and turned into Russia, a kleptocracy, more interested in stealing from each other than, imposing anything on their neighbors. China, obviously, is the shoe factory and the Apple factory of the world. It's not about to invade its customers in any time that I can imagine in the future. So with no industrial state enemies, why do we have a war machine that's 50% bigger than what Eisenhower thought was adequate? So that's one of the big themes in the book. I go through it in great detail. I show how it was this big war machine was inappropriately built during the 1980s and the Reagan buildup, which I fought when I was inside the White House, but of course I was kind of run over by the tanks as they came across the Potomac. But that buildup was unnecessary. By then, the Soviet Union was falling apart anyway, decaying, but it created this massive conventional force, naval forces, land forces, close air support, and so forth, that allowed the Bushes to undertake these two wars. If they had had to raise an army, as they used to say, and massively tax the people in order to have the wherewithal to invade the Middle East twice, first in 1991 and then in 2003, I don't think it would ever have happened. The last thing I was saying is we would never have a massive military force in the barren expanse of the Hindu Kush in Afghanistan if they had to raise an army and raise taxes for it. But the fact that it was there, an accidental legacy of a huge mistake in the Reagan era, of a violation of what I call Eisenhower's defense minimum, that's why we're in the foreign policy trouble that we have today, and partly why we have the massive fiscal problem that's sitting on our doorstep.
So there's the huge defense spending issue. You put you trace it heavily back to the Reagan years, but of course there's been a lot of bipartisan support for defense spending over the years. I want to push past defense spending, big as it is. We don't set that aside, but just move on as well. With each party, let's start with Republicans. I mean, you look at those two, you say George W. Bush, bankrupting the nation through misbegotten financed wars. But you also look at what you pin on Bush, Republicans, giant expansion of Medicare, a tax-cutting spree for the wealthy. In effect, the GOP embraced Keynesianism for the wealthy. You talk about the GOP's war against the 99%. We'll look at the Democrats, but what's your big indictment of Republicans in this period?
Well, because they've abandoned every basic principle that the Republican Party, the Conservative Party, stood for over the ages, as far as I'm concerned. The Republican Party was for fiscal rectitude, sound money, and free markets. What did the Republican Party do in recent times? They bailed out Wall Street. They bailed out the auto companies. That was done under Bush and the madman Hank Paulson, who was in the Treasury Secretary's office running the country during 2008. They've created massive deficits during the Bush era. All the Republicans want to blame Obama, and he has plenty to share. But the fact is, when Bush left town, the deficit was $1 trillion before Obama even got started. Okay, that was a Republican government, and it was a Republican government that had a Vice President Cheney who said Reagan proved deficits don't matter. Reagan proved nothing of the kind. Reagan really proved, not intentionally, that deficits are a drug. They're a danger, and it takes a long time for it to infect the policy process. But once it gets embedded, it becomes very difficult to change. And you saw that during the Bush era. There was more growth in domestic spending, both entitlements and discretionary, 8% a year in real terms, you know, after inflation, during the 8 years of Bush than there had been during the Kennedy-Johnson alleged guns and butter fiscal profligacy of the 1960s. It was far bigger growth than during Jimmy Carter. And obviously during Clinton, and I make him one of the so-called policy heroes in my book, because he actually did balance the budget three times in the late 1990s, there was hardly any growth at all.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with Ronald Reagan's famed budget director, David Stockman, about his dire new bipartisan indictment of Washington and his warning of American doom, really. His big, and I mean big, new book is The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David Stockman joins us from Washington. The book goes all the way back to the New Deal, says a bunch of the problems began right there in Stockman's view. Key moments of problems since then? Well, one is in 1971. Here it was in August, President Richard Nixon addressing the country, announcing the U.S. Would no longer officially trade dollars for gold.
The strength of a nation's currency is based on the strength of that nation's economy. And the American economy is by far the strongest in the world.
President Nixon went on to say, I have directed Secretary Connally to suspend temporarily the convertibility of the dollar into gold. Of course, it wasn't temporary. David Stockman says, big, big mistake. Let's get much more recent. September 19th, 2008, during the height of the financial crisis, President George W. Bush spoke at a White House press conference about the federal government's plans to contain the stock market collapse.
This is a pivotal moment for America's economy. Problems that originated in the credit markets and first showed up in the area of subprime mortgages have spread throughout our financial system.
Contagion, said George W. Bush, and then this, we must act now.
We must act now to protect our nation's economic health from serious risk.
And on came the bailouts. Big mistake, says David Stockman. But the warning was of depression there. He says, no, there was. He writes, there was never a remote threat of a Great Depression 2.0 or a financial nuclear winter. We'll look at that. Roger Lowenstein joins us in a moment, a big financial writer. David Stockman's book is The Great Deformation. David, we talked about Republican culpability as you see it here. What about the Democrats' role over the years?
Well, there's a lot of it. Just in recent times, the Democratic administration led the repeal of Glass-Steagall in 1999. They should have been the opponents of it because the great Democrat Carter Glass put that in 1933 as a way of disciplining banks that can get out of control, especially if you have an easy Fed and easy money and too much liquidity poured into them.
But that was under your hero, Bill Clinton. I mean, it was on his watch.
Well, Bill Clinton, I give great credit on the fiscal equation. Frankly, I don't think it was his decision necessarily to repeal Glass-Steagall. He signed it, but it was really the Keynesians around him and the Wall Street guys around him. Bob Rubin first from Goldman Sachs, Inc., and Larry Summers, the great Keynesian, current vicar on earth, as I call him, convinced him to do it, and it was a big mistake. Then you have many others, the Social Security issue. The Democrats continue to demagogue it, pretending that there's any money in the trust fund. It's all confetti paper. The $3 trillion is not real money. The system is broke in an economic sense, and we need to drastically reform it by means testing and taking the affluent elderly off Social Security so we can fund benefits on a means-tested basis for people who need it. Then we got the Obama stimulus. It was a total waste of money, in my view. $250 billion of that $800 went to middle-class tax cuts, borrowing and from the future, burying future generations in debt so that they could hand out $800 to American families to buy a new flat-screen TV or get another meal, at the Red Lobster Inn. This is not sensible. We can't force the economy to grow by borrowing huge amounts of money to the future from the future when we have as much debt as we do today. So when you look at it, it's been a bipartisan effort to pretend that if we print enough money, if we flood Wall Street with enough cash, if we have enough stimulus from the fiscal side of the equation and through every kind of tax cut known to man, both Republicans and Democrats have been behind it, credits for solar and every other thing in between, that somehow it's going to make the private enterprise system work better. I say this is the wrong approach. We've been on this track for decades, and now it's really catching up with us.
All those people are so wrong. I mean, in a reading of your book, it seems as though you want to go back pre-1933, pre the New Deal. And I guess the question there is, was the economy so great? What we're told is we've learned a lot. We've learned how to sort of manage the economy in a more nuanced way, how to buffer people from the market's worth depredations. I mean, some people are looking at what you're writing here and saying, was it really so great before? And have we not learned something? Looking at Jared Bernstein here, he says that your analysis is ahistorical, dystopic, a Hunger Games vision of America based on debt obsession and willful ignorance of macroeconomics and the impact of market failure when it goes down. What about it?
Well, I heard a lot of, invective in that. I didn't hear any analysis. Okay, I don't think it is unfair to say that we have massive financial bubbles today and violent cycles up and down that we really never had before, or that are the result of attempting to manage and level and control and peg the economy. You know, this collapse that we had in 2000-2001 was, drastic. The dot-com collapse wiped out $5 trillion of household wealth. Then we reflated the bubble. That wasn't the natural workings of the private market. That wasn't a cycle that was being managed by the Fed. That was a bubble that was being inflated. And we suck everybody in. People were taking on mortgages they couldn't afford. They were buying risky stocks that they didn't really understand. All kinds of speculation was occurring in Wall Street that was extremely dangerous, with all the toxic securities, securitized securities, and all the other things that were going on. And then the bubble collapsed again and the economy hit the skids. I don't think that's good management. I think that is the certain result of trying to manage the economy through interest rates and massive money creation at the Fed, or through constant stimulus out of Washington. Yeah, once upon a time, there was a modest notion that the fiscal authorities should lean gently against the cycle so they could support it a little bit at a true bottom of the business cycle and maybe restrain it a little bit at the top. That isn't what we do anymore. We have continuous, constant, and permanent stimulus because there is always somebody in Washington, some Keynesian economist or some politician looking for a reason to cut taxes or to spend, who can show that we're either just entering a downturn or we're still too weak coming out of one, or there's some reason to keep the stimulus going. So whatever the merit of that idea of countervailing or countercyclical policy might have been theoretically 50, 60 years ago. It's been tested in the laboratory of real-world politics, and it's failed. They're making it worse, not better. Mm. And I'm not saying it would be an ideal world to get out of the intervention business entirely, but frankly, on a basis of comparing the results of what we've been doing with the likely results of letting the free market economy function on its own, I would take the latter any day.
You're pretty much despairing about this changing. Everybody's so locked into it, the financial and political rewards in it so big. I mean, you do have a kind of agenda here, a little summary of things that you're suggesting: abolish deposit insurance, strangle the Fed, shrink the banks, adopt super Glass-Steagall, abolish bailouts, eliminate the Electoral College, strict term limits, balanced budget, no more economic subsidies, shrink the federal government, impose a 30% tax on wealth. Think about Cyprus, only big time. Eliminate income taxes, replace it with consumption taxes. Is that ever going to happen? And if it did, you know, you're pretty well placed since you left your government job. You've been off in the, sort of private sector at the very top. But wouldn't this be just so draconian that people would suffer enormously?
Well, you know, I say in that last chapter that these ideas are radical. They are sound, but they will never be adopted, and I put them in there not for an action program to implement tomorrow, but as a standard of measure to show how far off in the wrong direction policy is today. The idea, for instance, of a super Glass-Steagall breaking up the big banks. It follows the simple principle: if they're too big to fail, they're too big to exist. We shouldn't expose our financial system and our economy and the Main Street, populace in the United States to another meltdown of the type that we had in 2008. And if it was as dire as they say, and I have my doubts about that, but that's the way the politicians reacted, then let's cure the problem at the source by putting a limit of 1% of GDP on the banks, $150 billion. They can't be multi-trillion dollar monsters as they are today. And secondly, if they're going to be involved in trading or underwriting or capital markets or money management, then they can have access to deposit insurance, because that's for banks that take deposits and make business loans only. And they can't access the Fed window, so that is, borrow money cheaply from the Fed, so that if they make bad bets and get too much leverage on their balance sheet or too much of a mismatch between, their assets and liabilities, that they can be bailed out. Now, that is utopian, but it's actually sound, and we'll never get there because the crony capitalists of Wall Street have the congressional committees tied up lock, stock, and barrel, and instead of facing the problem, and here you have a progressive president who ran, against the 2% and for the 98% and was unwilling to take on Wall Street at all, what we got was Dodd-Frank, which is the greatest goofy, obscurantist waste of time that was ever undertaken in Washington, because it will not solve the problem. It will keep lawyers, accountants, and consultants in business forever. The banks will always find one more loophole, one more word they can twist. And the thing is nonsense, but it's a measure of why my program that you listed will never happen.
David's
Stockman, one item.
Yep, stand by there for just a moment if you would. The new book is The Great Deformation. David Stockman joins us from Washington. With us right now from Newton, Massachusetts, Roger Lowenstein, journalist, writer, been covering the financial world and economy for decades for the New York Times, Wall Street Journal, and more. Author most recently of The End of Wall Street, currently working on a book about the origins of the Federal Reserve. Roger Lowenstein, thanks for joining us.
Hey, Tom. Always good to be on the program.
What do you think of David Stockman's analysis and his forward view of what ought to happen? Maybe utopian, but sound, he says. What are you hearing, Roger?
Well, some of it's utopian. Some of it, I think, is dystopian. It's a broad brush, but let me just pick out a few things. You get the sense, listening to David, that speculation was invented by the Federal Reserve. And I think he said that, you know, we never had these types of bubbles and speculations before. That's completely wrong. I mean, if you go back to the tulip bubble in Holland or the South Sea bubble in the 1700s or in this country in 1873, we had a massive bubble and crash and a six-year depression. And then again in the 1890s, this is why the Federal Reserve was created. The U.S. was, if you think of a town that instead of having a fire department, everybody had their own well in their backyard.
Yeah.
There was no central reserve of money, and that's why they created the Federal Reserve. And, you know, even in the year in the 1920s, when the Fed was a much smaller presence and government was much smaller, we of course had massive speculation. And the recent problems we've had, he talked about the dot-com bubble and of course the mortgage crash. They were basically creations of the private market, not of the government. Not that the government hasn't made all kinds of mistakes, but nobody in government told people to get silly about the price of Yahoo and Priceline and Amazon.
Should Bush and Paulson have let the financial giants come down in 08?
Well, Paulson wanted to, and he did, if you remember. He let Lehman Brothers fail. He said it's time for a big bank to...
but not more. And the warning was, we'll have a super depression. And David Stockman says no.
Well, people weren't very happy when Lehman failed. And I don't know how David Stockman knows, because unemployment went up to 10.5%. We had 15 million people unemployed. I think it's a little cavalier to say that, millions more potentially the country should lose their jobs because of some standard of purity or, ideological, pureness that he wants to adhere to. We had experience with this in the Depression. People say that the New Deal didn't work, but in fact it reduced unemployment from something like 25% to 1932-3 to 12% or so in 1937. They said that was enough, and they went back to a balanced budget, and we went right back into it in 1937-8. And Keynesian is not some sort of magic. What Keynesian deficit spending says is, if you're operating normally on a balanced budget, if you go into hard times, people are going to be earning less. They'll be paying less in taxes. You'll automatically go into a deficit. If you were to then turn around and say, we have to have a balanced budget, you'd have to hike people's taxes in the middle of a recession, and you'd create a depression.
But David Stockman's right. The Fed has been pumping a lot, and almost unimaginable amount of money out there. I mean, despite the market being up so high now, he sees a big cliff coming. I mean, what about this notion that baked into here that we're essentially doomed, that we're on a bad track of doom, and we can't get off it?
David was budget director in the 80s. People said we were doomed because Japan was going to take over everything. In the 70s, we're doomed because we had inflation and a recession at the same time. I mean, I think if you look at the long haul, this country has overcome a lot of crises. I don't think we're doomed. We have a bad deficit right now and a lot of debt. Most of it is the effect of the two things, of the Bush tax cuts and of the reduced economic performance. And if you you got rid of all the Bush tax cuts, not just those on upper income families, and when the economy comes back, you'll get back to an even keel in the budget, with one exception, and that, of course, is health care spending. But
there's this idea that it can't come back because it's so bound up in crony, subsidies.
I mean, that's a catchy phrase. I don't know what it means. I want to respond to one thing in particular, which is deposit insurance. I mean, he's very right. It's a radical notion. He's very wrong that it's a sound notion.
You mean abolishing it?
To abolish it. Banks... People don't think about banks as lenders and borrowers, but that's where they are. They borrow people from lots of people, the depositors, and then they lend them out to industry and so on, and real estate and all sorts of things. But there's a catch. The catch is, when you give your money to a bank, you want it back at any moment. It's a short-term deposit on demand. And the banks will lend it out long-term. And the only way that works, the only way that banks are able to transform lots of people's little short-term loans into long-term capital so society can grow, is some way of keeping the money there. And the way we do that is deposit insurance, so people don't get worried about the bank failing and run to the bank.
Roger Lowenstein, we're up against a break right here. I think we're going to take it back to David Stockman, but you've given us a lot of grist to work with there, some grit in the wheels. Roger Lowenstein, author of The End of Wall Street. Look for his book coming on the origins of the Fed. Roger, thank you so much for joining us.
Always good, Tom.
Tom Ashbrook, this is On Point. We're talking this hour with Ronald Reagan's famed budget director, David Stockman, about his dire new bipartisan indictment of Washington and his warning of, essentially, American doom. His huge new book is The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. You can read an excerpt at our website, onpointradio.org. David Stockman, you hear Roger Lowenstein's pushback there. He says, no, it's not perfect, but you start abolishing deposit insurance and imagining the markets are going to be so swell on their own, and we're ignoring risk and history.
Well, you know, I was listening in 10 minutes. Roger said 20 things, and I lost track after that, that I disagree with fundamentally, that represent what I call the conventional wisdom of the status quo, the Keynesian wisdom that has led us to what I call this point of inflection, this danger, this imminent sundown in America. I couldn't begin to answer all of them, but let me take one recent and one a long time ago. Mm-hmm. Obviously, speculation has been in the breast of mankind since time immemorial. Mm. My argument is that when you give free money, or 10 basis points is what the overnight borrowing rate is today, you encourage that speculative impulse enormously. You cause normal people to become reckless because the easy money allows them to borrow for nothing, buy something that they think might go up or produce a yield, and hope nothing goes wrong while they're collecting the spread. So that's the problem. Now, the second thing I would point out is when he said the private sector did the housing bust, the private sector was responsible for the huge credit bubble that ended in the meltdown of 2008. No, that's not true. The private sector was the instrument of execution, but it was the 1% money that Greenspan passed out at the Fed, hand over fist, that allowed the Wall Street banks to set up these huge warehouse lines, as they call them, mm-hmm. that put money in the hands of local brokers who really weren't even mortgage bankers, who had some of them never been in the business. They were aluminum siding salesmen and used car yep. salesmen and so forth, took that Wall Street money, went out and wrote a mortgage to anybody that had a pulse, and then sent those mortgages to Wall Street where they were sliced and diced into securities and sold all over the world, including fishing villages in Norway. That was totally a consequence of the Greenspan bubble policies. The Wall Street never would have put billions of dollars out into Main Street used car salesmen unless they could borrow it for nothing and collect the spread.
Let me ask you, we may well have gone off the rails in some ways there, but just if we look back in a big historical sweep, because you ask us to do that here, you've got 80 years of history, and you go back to FDR in 1933, taking the U.S. off the gold standard, you sort of mark that as the beginning of the end this sort of dystopian evolution here. But I don't know if there's, I don't have all these numbers, but I was reading in the Atlantic, they say that, look, you want us to go back to the gold standard, but the Atlantic says that the U.S. economy was in recession 52% of the time between 1874 and 1933 when FDR took us off gold. And since then, we've been in recession just 16% of the time. Does that
argue for something else? No, but those numbers are totally wrong. The go-to scholar on economic performance and growth in the 19th century from 1870, let's say, to 1914, the eve of World War I, you can't count the period after that because the war disrupted everything. But in that 50 years, the go-to scholar is Christina Romer,
yes.
who was chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors for Obama, so she's not some mm-hmm. wingnut. Mm-hmm. And her data demonstrates that real growth in that 50-year period was in the range of 4%, the highest in history. Industrial production growth averaged 6 or 7%. Real living standards rose during that period at the highest rate or an equal rate of any time before or after. And when they come up with these silly charts that were produced by some green eye shade at some point back by the National Bureau of Economic Research, no one even knew what GDP was in 1873 or 1884 or 1990. There were booms and slumps in a economy that was growing rapidly, but even the great scholar of the so-called banking panics of the Gilded Age, that period, and he's not a wingnut either, he's a pedigree degreed economist, his name is Elmas Wicker, showed that of the five big market crashes or banking panics of that era, three of them had zero effect, none whatsoever, on the entire heartland interior economy of the United States. They occurred only because of speculation on Wall Street that zoomed and then crashed, and the economy then resumed, you know, things went forward without any spillover effect at all. So, you know, we have a huge debate in this country because the proponents of the status quo have mythologized the history of pre-1914. They've mythologized the New Deal. The only thing that happened in 1936 that caused the economy to boom a little bit was there was an enormous veterans bonus payment that FDR vetoed. It was overridden by Republicans and Democrats. It was the equivalent of $1 trillion of money that went out the door overnight to veterans. They spent it all. The economy boomed in 36 and 37. And when all the bonus money was spent, the economy, resumed back or reverted back to the kind of depression level that it was stuck at during most of the New Deal. It was only World War II that brought us out. Now, I'm not saying that we've made no progress since then. Mm. We've had a lot of growth because the private enterprise free market economy has, despite all the hurdles and all of the harm that's done by the Fed and Washington, continued to grow. My argument is that it's progressive, it's cumulative, and each cycle over the last decades has gotten worse, so that by today, the Fed is really out of control, a bubble machine. Washington's budget is a doomsday machine. They can't stop it. It's a cumulative buildup over many decades that now has brought the private economy to a halt. And we can see that there's been no growth to speak of for the last 10 or 12 years.
David, let me bring up my listeners in here, if I may. Terry in Newport, Rhode Island, you're on the air with David Stockman.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I'm going to go out and buy his book as soon as I get off the phone.
It'll keep you busy for 6 months. Okay.
I've lived his book. I'm part of that sandwich generation. And a kind of a product of what he's talking about, what the government has done. Because after I graduated from college, I joined the military as a part of Reagan's buildup to the 600-ship Navy. Well, you know, 17 years later, they decide they don't need me. So I was retired early with the drawdown from Clinton. So I have four part-time jobs right now trying to support aging parents who only have Social Security because they lost half of their wealth in that other bubble. I have a son in college who's depending on Pell Grants and loans. Over the course of my military career, I've jumped from party to party figuring out who am I going to support, because they keep changing and they keep making these really, really bad decisions for people, me and everybody else.
Terry, are you ready with all of that? And we hear it. Are you ready to kind of scrape us back to a pre-1933 kind of approach? Or does that sound too draconian?
To me, I kind of agree. I absolutely agree with means testing. I think people that are have really, really good retirement shouldn't be taking Social Security from the government. I have a military retirement, thank God, and so I have a level of security that a lot of my friends don't have.
Yep.
People are worried. I tell everybody, you better start to hunker down. I think it is going to get worse.
Terry, resonating very clearly. You're right. That's a story that flows right along with David Stockman's narrative in many ways. I've got a lot of listeners waiting. Thank you, Terry. Peter in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Peter, you're on.
Yes, hello.
Hi.
I have the feeling that a lot of this goes back a lot farther than the 30s. I mean, you have back in the 18th century a mixture of capitalism and Christianity and Calvinism, and it's all kind of pulled forward into this. And I'm rather worried that we seem to be on a kind of a course that it seems to be rather difficult to get off. And I agree, and it was funny for me to be listening because I agree with both Mr. Lowenstein and Mr. Stockman in different ways. And I wonder about the social fabric, though, because I spent a lot of time in Canada where the social fabric basically is holding up reasonably well. And do you become a failed society if you allow your citizens to sink to the depth one secondly, if you allow political elites of either stripe to take over the levers of political institutions, and then what that does, and then also this business of just sort of being propelled forward, striving for the next corner, for the next deal, and the next bubble, and the next profit, over the greater common good, but also the about having some continuity of the path that you're on.
Peter, let us pick it up right there. David Stockman, you quite explicitly warn about the social fabric, about, I mean, it's not hard to read you as warning of even a kind of failed state in this country. Is Peter hearing more than you're suggesting?
No, I don't think so. I think we've never been here before. We have not had deficits of this magnitude. We have not had money politics of this potency that really has just locked down and taken over the democratic process of governance. Certainly, we've never had a Fed creating bubble after bubble after bubble, larger each time than we have today. So how it all unwinds when it inevitably does is beyond the ability of anybody to predict, because it's uncharted water. It's not been done or experienced in history before. But I will say that the one thing that comes through both of these calls that I want to make clear is I believe the only job the government can afford to do today is to maintain and finance and manage an adequate social safety net for people who are left behind, like the parents of Terry, who mm-hmm. have nothing but Social Security. They get it. If people do need food stamps or income supplementation because they're working four jobs and they're still not making enough money, as Terry was, mm-hmm. making enough money to support their family, then I'm all for an earned income credit, tax credit, to top off what she's earning as, you know, she works so hard in these four jobs.
But let's be clear, you're not saying that on top of everything else the federal government does. You're saying that may be the only thing.
That's the main thing, the major thing it ought to do. Refocus its resources on a safety net that will help the people who are spilling off the wagon and struggling to find a part-time job or to, you know, 75 years old and get by on a Social Security.
And the Pentagon and subsidies and investments in the future. What about those?
Well, the Pentagon needs to be dramatically cut back because we don't need a war machine of this size in a world where there's no industrial state enemies.
You got North Korea talking about nuclear weapons right now. I mean, it can look like it's...
Korea, I mean, you know, it's run by a clown, okay? North Korea.
A clown with nuclear weapons.
Well, but he can't deliver them to an island 100 miles off the shore of North Korea. He can't certainly threaten the United States in any way, shape, or form. It's a problem maybe in the region. They ought to let the Chinese take care of their client state anyway. I just think it's a lot of drum beating, war drum beating, and scary stories in the night that shouldn't trouble us. Okay?
You say turn around Citizens United, put very strict limits on politicians going into lobbying and more. I mean, you want to tighten it up in so many ways, but then you say we're probably not going to do it. We're in an end stage metastasis. It's easy to read this, David, and just sort of slap one's forehead and say, "Oh, forget it. We're done. Close it down."
Well,
but that's not an American impulse.
No, and that's not the intention, but the problem is if you're politically correct, you always have to have a solution that will make everything all better tomorrow or next year or in a decade from now. I'm arguing that we have engaged in such massive drift errors and painted ourselves into such huge corners fiscally, in terms of our economic system, which is beginning to falter and leave Main Street full of people struggling to get by because of part-time jobs and because of the way things have unfolded, lost money in the bubbles. They've been lured into the dot-com boom and got nailed. They were lured into the mortgage boom and got nailed. They were lured into the stock market in 2007, 2008. So I'm saying that in that kind of environment, it's going to be very difficult to unwind all this. But I did want to lay out what would need to be done if you wanted to really clear the decks and reset the system. And
who's going to do it? Our listener, Michigan, writes, hey, wait a minute. Yeah, Clinton signed, you know, the end of Glatt-Steagall, but it was Republican initiatives. Quite true. You say Paul Ryan, all hat and no cattle, intellectually dishonest, budget plans bogus. You're very critical of President Obama's spending. You sound kind of like a Ron Paul guy here. Who's going to do this, David?
It's not going to be done, and that's why I think we have far more danger ahead than people are willing to be honest about. And, you know, if that means that you use a phrase like sundown in America to call attention to the enormity of the problem, that's what you have to do. And I think it's going to be very difficult to find a way out of this. One, because people are in the bubble. They don't believe. They're not alarmed. You know, the establishment tells you not to worry. You have a, you know, journalist like Roger Lowenstein saying, oh, well, this stuff works. It's proved out and has a, you know, a rationalization and excuse forever for everything. And so, therefore, the public doesn't have a clear view of how far things have gone. But frankly, listening to what people in everyday America are saying on Main Street, I think they're on to the fact that you can't trust anything you're hearing from Wall Street or Washington.
It's hard to operate if you are right, it's hard to operate in a country in a system where you can't trust what you're hearing from your biggest institutions.
That's true.
are you a Tea Party guy? Where are you coming down politically with all this?
Well, you know, I don't think either party is both parties have failed. They're basically glorified concierges who function to introduce their politicians to PACs and money and K Street and stand for nothing. So until we have a total political, you know, realignment in this country, I wouldn't count on either party to be honest about these problems.
Ladies and gentlemen, hang on to your hats. If David Stockman is anywhere near right, the new book is The Great Deformation, The Corruption of Capitalism in America. David, thanks very much for being with us.
Join being with you.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.